This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the time of coronavirus, we're all, it seems, amateur epidemiologists trying to find a way past the contagion that's overturned our lives. We follow the headlines. You might learn about the breakthroughs on Twitter or Facebook, but often they first appear on what are called preprint servers. In fact, Ivan Oransky, professor of medical journalism at NYU and co-founder of Retraction Watch, says that many of the purported breakthroughs around the virus are being shared in spaces that are completely unvetted.
So essentially no one has seen them. There's something that a lot of preprint servers refer to as a sort of sanity check. Like, is it so beyond the realm of what could be true? If you're putting up astrology on an astronomy preprint server, you're probably not going to get through that barrier, but it's a really low bar.
There is a torrent of data being released by preprint servers that are filling in some of the holes in our understanding, maybe not very accurately, but at least it gives us something to grab onto.
There clearly is a desperate need, and what you don't want to do is sort of withhold information from people. But what you do want to do is make sure that it is vetted at some point.
But you know that even vetting isn't going to necessarily yield perfect research. Trump going overboard on that drug, hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine, yeah.
That came from a peer-reviewed paper. The author of it was one of the editors-in-chief of the journal it was printed in.
Yeah, in that case, it was actually technically peer-reviewed, but would it have appeared in another journal? I think the rule of thumb about no single study actually still holds. So if it is the first study to show something, no matter how strong it looks, it's about whether or not it's been replicated, whether someone has repeated something very similar to it and found a similar result, not about whether that particular paper holds up. President Trump was, in fact, pointing to a single peer-reviewed paper. It's tragic and completely predictable that after that press conference, a couple drank their fish tank cleaner because it includes chloroquine.
Another problem with peer review that you point to is the sheer volume of papers, something like 3 million a year?
That's right. That's 3 million papers, 2 to 3 peer reviewers per paper. Scientists tell me when you're doing a peer review well and properly, it takes them on average about half a day. So, you know, call that 4 hours. 4 hours, 2.5 reviewers, that's 10 hours per paper. 3 million papers, that's 30 million hours. And some of those papers were reviewed several times at several journals because they were rejected the first or second or eighth time. So do that math. And by the way, the number of peer review requests to researchers who are experts in coronavirus now, imagine that. Just you would probably have, I don't know, 1 an hour based on the number that we're seeing. You can't possibly do them. And so what happens? Well, that peer review ends up being done by the next person in line or the eighth person in line, somebody the editor can find, but it's not someone who can really do the expert kind of analysis.
Can you give us an example of some stuff that's gotten out there in the mainstream that has subsequently been debunked?
There was a paper in early February that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was a letter to the editor, which gets a much lighter peer review treatment generally, but it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the world's premier medical journals. It had their stamp of approval. They did what they could to get it out.
And what did it say?
It said that you could actually spread the virus if you didn't have symptoms yet. And now there's some evidence that that may be true, although, again, we're still in a preliminary phase. But at the time, there wasn't clear-cut evidence for what was in it. The people who wrote it might not have even seen the patient themselves. There was a lot of confusion there. And it stood for about a week until Kai Kupferschmidt of Science Magazine, who's been reporting a lot on this these issues very well, I should add, exposed the fact that there were some problems in this paper. There was another paper that came out in a virology journal that claimed to show that there were two very distinct subtypes of the virus. One of them was really virulent, and the other one maybe wasn't quite as dangerous. I'm oversimplifying that, but you may have seen headlines about these two subtypes of virus. That paper, which, by the way, hasn't had any correction on it or anything, just for the record, was very well debunked by actually a couple of virologists. There was actually a preprint that came out on a Friday afternoon at the end of January. The punchline of that paper was that because these researchers saw a lot of common proteins in this coronavirus with other viruses, including HIV, they therefore concluded, and I think this is where they just went way off the rails, that this was clearly an engineered bioterror agent. That paper was actually withdrawn within 40 hours on a Sunday. There are papers that are coming out now no one's actually going to see in order to vet properly. You know, the example of hydroxychloroquine, if you look at the downstream effects of a single paper of only a couple dozen patients switching the entire world into actually a shortage of hydroxychloroquine, which, by the way, is a drug that people with lupus very much need. It's great that there's a clinical trial going on. It sounds like something we should be trying, but we're way ahead of the evidence, and we need to be careful.
So then, do you think that there is a role for preprints, that the flow of information is essential for collaboration among scientists themselves, and that it helps us cycle through ideas faster?
I do think there's a very positive role for preprints. Science doesn't happen only when a paper is published. If anything, the horse has left the barn and you're closing the door by publishing that paper because it takes so long to publish a paper. So preprints can absolutely help scientific information flow, but you shouldn't go to a preprint server and say, well, it's got some scientist's name on it. It must be kosher. We have to stop thinking about it in a binary way and think, probably a high percentage of it's going to turn out to be wrong. But preprint servers, if they've gotten the word out sooner, let other people try and replicate the experiment.
One last thing. For health and science journalists, this is absent the gunfire and continuous mortal danger, your version of war reporting, which means you're subject to fatigue and the fog of this pandemic.
Yeah, I think that all of the things that are, if you will, problematic about war reporting and yet ultimately incredibly necessary about war reporting are present here. I think what you have to do is actually acknowledge the fog of war, not feel the need to react to absolutely every pronouncement, every study. That's really hard to do. Pretending there aren't bullets flying over you. How do you do the dispassionate kind of reporting that you need to do in a case like this? But there are reporters who are experienced at war reporting in the same way there are reporters who are experienced at health and science reporting that was part of how they sat down to report and do that story.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. Always a pleasure.
Ivan Oransky is the vice president of editorial at Medscape, a leading journalism and healthcare site for healthcare professionals, and professor of medical journalism at NYU.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.